I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the American Senate and Insider's History. Richard Baker is our guest, appointed the Senate's first official historian, and it's a post he held from 1975 until his retirement in 2009. He came to Washington in 1968 to join the Legislative Reference Service, and he later served as Senate curator and then became director of research for the Government Research Corporation. When the Senate established the historical office in 1975, he accepted the position of Senate historian and was responsible for the day-to-day operations of this office. It was established in the wake of the Watergate investigation and emphasized the importance of record keeping after President Richard Nixon's efforts to destroy official documents. We'll talk about Watergate during part of our conversation, but what the heck, we got a long period to talk about for American history and some of the senatorial giants. We'll probably start with Clay Calhoun and Webster, some people who have been senators who have been terrific orators. And we'll look at what the framers had in mind when they created the Senate, what George Washington had to say to Thomas Jefferson, if that story is true. If not, it's okay. It's a good story. And how it has been used as an investigative body for quite some period of time, when it's really been a shining body and when it's been problematic, and why in the world it's so partisan now, and has it been so partisan in other times in history? There's a lot to talk about. We'll welcome your phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Richard Baker, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am too. It'll be a great hour. So you went on a high school field trip to Washington, D.C., and you loved the city. Is that what happened?
That's about it, yes.
I love that city as well. I never got to live there, which I should have done sometime in my life, but it's interesting. And you talk about the importance of internships for many of these people who were interns and then became senators, but that an event in your life can really move you in a certain direction.
Absolutely. When I was in high school, or even before high school, I got to sit in on a board of aldermen's meeting for my local town and got to be alderman for the day. And that kind of got into my bloodstream, the whole idea of the way that legislators and legislatures make laws. And then when I was in college, I took a course in practical politics and followed the election campaign in 1960 of a Massachusetts Republican named Leverett Saltonstall. And found the ennobling parts of political life, but also very quickly came into some of the darker corners. And so it just made me want to learn more.
Yeah.
That's what they've been doing.
Yeah, and that's what's in the book, The Illustrious and the Darker Corners. So is this story true or not true? Washington explaining to Jefferson how the drafters of the Constitution designed the two bodies to be different, and as Jefferson was pouring his coffee into a saucer to cool it, Washington said, that's the role of the Senate. It's there to cool the hot legislation coming from the House.
That story is too good to disprove.
It's a great story, isn't it?
Don't ruin a good story with a fact. That story first emerged in the 1860s. We tried to trace it back further than that and couldn't do it. But it's a great way when you're talking to either a high school group or a middle school group or a group of brand new senators to kind of explain the differences between the House and the Senate.
It must have been, I'm wondering how much debate there was, because when you think about it, and you've thought about it more than any of us, to have this body where you have two people elected from small states, big states, it doesn't make any difference. It's a very strange construction in some ways, isn't it?
It really is, and it was clear that in order to get the states to approve the Constitution, they had to make it very clear that the individual states, as states, would have basically a veto power over any nationally based legislation. And so, in fact, some of the early discussions in the Constitutional Convention talked about the Senate as a council of states, similar to some, what some foreign countries have. It took the Senate, and of course the senators were originally elected by the state legislatures. So if the senator wasn't doing his job, say in the case of John Quincy Adams in the early 1800s, basically the state legislature could say, we don't want you there anymore. And they couldn't actually force him to leave, but they could make it very miserable for him. And of course, when the six-year term expired, they would be sure to choose someone else.
Mm-hmm. The men who wrote the Constitution, you say, miscalculated the evolution of American politics. They assumed future generations would, can you believe this, shun partisan politics.
You know, that's right. They really was no sense that right from almost the very first day that Congress was in session, that members would begin to form into political parties. They George Washington expressed his hope that people would be above partisanship, and but then they had to decide, well, how are we going to assign committees, committee positions, and how are we going to decide how to raise money and how to spend that money? And very quickly, the sort of two groups formed, two natural groups that are with us still today. Though the group that says there is the responsibility on the part of the national government to look out for the broader interests of the country, and then the other group said, no, the states are sovereign. And there was really that sense that the states were independent, and that went right up until the Civil War, when some southern states decided that they were going to exercise their sovereignty by getting out of the Union.
Yeah.
So those are issues that were with us for a long time, and the thing that I find fascinating is that many of those issues that were debated at the Constitutional Convention are still very much with us today.
Interesting. Let's talk about some of the members, the more illustrious members, and let's go way back. We think of these three, and they've been called giants. Tell me why they are and if they are worth being called giants. Clay, Calhoun, and Webster.
Well, one of the main reasons is that they were willing to compromise. Something that some members of the modern Senate forget, that's a kind of a fundamental part of being a legislator. You really have to push and make your case as hard as you can, but then if you want any legislation at all, you have to kind of settle for half a loaf. And Clay Webster and Calhoun, of course, were active at a time when the nation was severely tested as a result of slavery, as a result of the nation's expansion across the continent, and lots of issues on how this should all develop. And these three were hardly unified throughout that period, and they grew to hate one another and contest one another. But it was the Compromise of 1850, which was really the work of Henry Clay, that, as historians love to say, held the nation together long enough for it to get a decent president who could then lead in a time of crisis, obviously Abraham Lincoln, and not Millard Fillmore or Franklin Pierce.
Mm-hmm. Were they really smart?
They were, particularly Clay, who was whip smart, as one historian called him, and who was a brilliant debater. And of course, the Senate chamber of the time, today it's restored, looked pretty much as it did in the mid 19th century. But it was like a semicircular room, almost like a Roman amphitheater, and the acoustical values of it were splendid. So that somebody with Clay's voice and his manner and his gestures, and he would stop and he would pause and he would take a word and he would kind of turn it over several times, and then he'd utter it again. These were all people of that rank in terms of debaters were accustomed also to speaking outdoors to large audiences, and so they had to enunciate very clearly. We have a chapter in the book on the nature of Senate debate and how it has evolved over the years. But Clay and Webster kind of fell out with Calhoun, and of course they were significant because each one came to represent the three major sections of the country, and Clay being the man of the West and Webster of the Northeast and Calhoun of the South. And as their relationship began to deteriorate, so too did relationships relations among the states, and we inched closer to civil war.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the period prior to the 17th Amendment and why there was a need, and we saw it in action, for the 17th Amendment. How extensive was bribery of state legislators to get people to vote for you?
Very.
Was
very
it?
The amazing thing is that it took so long for the 17th Amendment providing for direct popular election of senators to be ratified by the states, even to be proposed in Congress. The first proposal was put before Congress in 1826, and it took until well into the into the 20th century before the 17th Amendment was adopted. But wealthy manufacturers or others would simply go to a state legislature, particularly to the upper house, which in those days may have only had 15, 20, no more than 30 members, and all they needed was a majority of that small body to block the election of a new senator. And there were wealthy people who would say, "Look, I understand you've got a mortgage. We'll take care of the mortgage." fairly well-documented cases. Sometimes it was just sort of, walking around money of $15 for a vote. But in other cases, it was multiple thousands of dollars back in the days when that kind of money really went a long way. And the result was that many prominent public figures in individual states would throw their hat into the ring, figuring, well, this is going to be a deadlock, and this election, and maybe I will, lightning will strike, and I will win. And so it kept states, in some cases, for choosing, for replacing or reelecting their senators for as long as 2 years. And there was, at the beginning of the 20th century, Delaware went without both of its senators for 2 years because of the deadlocks in the state legislature. And there was a journalist named David Graham Phillips who wrote a book called The Treason of the Senate in the early part of the 20th century about the grafters and the corruptors and all the bribery. And that went a long way as well as some major deadlocks in electing senators, went a long way toward the final passage and ratification of the 17th Amendment.
Well, then you had this progressive era, people like Fightin' Bob La Follette from here in Wisconsin. How important was that election to achieving reform?
It was very important, and Bob La Follette was very important to...
Whoops. Oh, I don't know where he went. We'll have to reestablish the connection. And while we're doing that, we'll just take a little pause here. We're talking about the American Senate this hour of the program, and a very, very interesting guest. He's the co-author of The American Senate, An Insider's History, Richard Baker. Richard was appointed the Senate's first official historian, a post he held from 75 until his retirement in 2009. And his co-author is... Neil McNeil, a founding member of the PBS program Washington Week, who covered the Senate in 1949 and served as Time Magazine's chief congressional correspondent for 30 years. He died in 2008, and the manuscript he gave to Richard, and Richard completed it and gave it to us. So we'll be welcoming phone calls. Did I give you the number? Here's the number if you want to join the conversation, bring up great senators or... senators who were pretty shady or great orators. We would love to hear from you because he's got the record on all of them. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And our Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So while we try to, I don't know what happened, all of a sudden we just got a dial tone, and that's what we're getting now when we call, so something happened to his phone. But don't worry, he'll be calling us. He's a responsible guy, and He'll figure it out here. We're talking about the U.S. Senate, what the founders had in mind, why it's so partisan now. We have to get to the point where there were duels in the Senate. The co-author of The American Senate, An Insider's History, is our guest, and he was appointed the Senate's first official historian and was in that role from 1975 until 2009. We thought it would be fun, actually, we kind of found this, and we thought it would be fun to have a wee bit of a quiz. There's not much of a prize other than getting your name announced toward the end of the show, if you get this right. This is a clip we're about to play of the mellifluous former U.S. senator who also had a best-selling record. Can you guess who it is? And post your answer on our Facebook page. We'll read the name of the person or the people. Maybe there'll be all kinds of you because you're great historical buffs who guessed correctly. So here's how you do it. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook, and you may want to like us when you're there, and you'll get our updates of shows, so you'll always be informed. Okay, you ready? Who is this former U.S. senator who had a best-selling record? And we'll tell the story about him later on in the show and tell you if you won or not. Here we go. Ready? Okay.
Down through the years, there have been men, brave, gallant men, have died that others might be free. And even now, they do it still. Brave, gallant men know that someone must.
All right, there's your historical question. No prize, really. Just we'll read your name on the air if you get it right. So who was that former U.S. senator? And that is from a best-selling album of his. U.S. senator with a best-selling album. Go to our Facebook page. We'll read the names later on in the show. And we will not talk about that senator until then. Don't worry. We won't give it away. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Our phone number, and we have found our guest again, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join us on air. That was weird. I don't know what happened to your ear. Everything just went to a dial tone, Richard.
That must have been what I was saying.
Well, you were talking about Bob La Follette, so we don't want to miss that.
he is a model today, and you know, despite the fact that he was despised by many of his opponents during World War I, in terms of being able to give long-winded speeches on the floor of the Senate in favor of free speech, but he's today a model of what it means to be a good senator, and there's no lack of interest in finding models for being a good and effective senator.
Yeah. And I'm wondering what senators thought about being directly elected. All of a sudden, you're going to have to answer to a whole different crowd, the people of America. Were they very upset about that or wildly enthusiastic?
You know, that's a very astute question, because that was a huge issue at the time, and it turned out to be a non-issue. Every senator who was up for re-election in 1914, the first year that amendment was in effect, won re-election. Despite all the arguments and fears that this is going to, the worst thing they could say about the quality of senators that the 17th Amendment might produce is that they'll all be like House members, you know, elected by the people, by the riffraff.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, they pretty much went along as in the past, and it really did not solve the major problem that they thought they could solve, namely the problem of bribery, because the bribery just kind of recirculated into campaign financing.
Right. Right, and it's still there.
Need to elaborate on that idea.
Exactly. Let's go to phone calls. We have a full bank of people wanting to speak with you. Todd in Madison, hi. Todd, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
Oh, hello. I've read that the basic structure of the government was based on the Iroquois Confederacy, like the separation of power and one house representing population and one representing just by the state. I was just wondering if that was true.
It was. I think that's it's fair to say. You know, it was also based on the Continental Congress and the Congress under the Articles of Confederation, which had just one chamber, and of course no president of the United States. And it was the failings of that, the frustrations of that, plus the limitations. You know, they didn't want to give it taxing power without unanimous votes. That really caused a number of compromises to begin to give power to both what became the Senate and the House of Representatives. So yes, these the people who wrote the Constitution were not only aware of that earlier model, but also of course of the British Parliament and other governments in terms of how do you allocate power in such a way that it won't, cause huge problems, and in the case of the United States, deprived people of their power to elect and govern themselves.
Thank you, Todd. We go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest could tell us who the Senate set aside a room in the Senate building to hear this senator give speeches, because he was getting so many people that were coming from around the country that wanted to hear what he had to say.
No, I don't know, because there are a number of suspects on that one. Generally, the senator who was involved could go out of his way to himself arrange a room so that his constituents or her constituents could come and hear him talk. I have an idea, but I don't want to destroy the quiz.
Oh, okay, okay. Thanks, and there's a little clue for those of you who are still wondering. Thanks very much for the call. I'm interested in some of the records here, Richard. Did you discover some records in the basement of the Capitol or somewhere in D.C. that were just treasure troves of the history?
You know, yes, and it was almost a heartbreaking story that turned out to be very well. Back in 2002, as construction was proceeding on the what is now known as the Capitol Visitor Center, underground on the east front of the Capitol, just as the bulldozers were about to dig in to that particular subterranean portion where there was a basement, a clerk walked by the room that was going to be destroyed and looked in and saw some old ledgers just sitting there. That was the room that belonged to the Senate Dispersing Office. They said, no, we have nothing of value down there. Anything that's there is trash, and you can go ahead and destroy it. Well, the clerk then grabbed this one ledger that turned out to be the salary ledger that ran from 1791 to 1882, I think. And it was signed by the Senate's presiding officer, which was in most cases was the Vice President of the United States. So this, and there was no other version of this particular ledger. So we got a hold of it, and immediately enormous media attention. I ended up on the PBS NewsHour carrying that book down to the Arlington station, Channel 26. And it developed an awful lot of interest in, it's one of those, one more horror story of how vital documents sometimes come very close to being destroyed.
Right, but it turned out to be quite an exciting day for you.
It was, yes.
I'm interested in, let's go to periods in history where the Senate really has performed its work as a very important investigative body. I'm interested, because I watched a lot of these hearings in the Watergate hearings that took place. And you write about Edward Kennedy, we think of now as one of the giants of the Senate. I found this story really interesting, that he was chair of a judiciary subcommittee, and he and his staff undertook a preliminary inquiry into the burglary at the Watergate. But Mike Mansfield also became interested, and he didn't want Kennedy to be leading this investigation. Is that the story?
That's the story. You've got it exactly right. And, of course, Mike Mansfield was the Senate Democratic Majority Leader at the time, so he had a little more power and a little more say over how that would all go about. And he decided that maybe the most appropriate chairman would be this distinguished Southern gentleman from North Carolina, Senator Sam Ervin. So Sam Ervin became, who was rather an obscure legislator, became a figure of national reverence almost, the way he conducted those hearings.
Yes, he did. Was there a jealousy? Did Mansfield not want Kennedy to rise through the ranks somehow?
I thought he thought that he would, you know, he was a little concerned about the Kennedy name, that's always, you know, a great way to attract a lot of media attention. And although he had respect for Ted Kennedy, although that was not the best time in Ted Kennedy's life in terms of some of his private activities.
Right.
And Mansfield just didn't want to lose control over that investigation. And he felt he would maintain control if he looked to one of the stalwart senior chairmen in the Senate. And he found a good one in Sam Ervin.
Wasn't he just the perfect person for that job? He was so respected.
He certainly was. He probably even grew into the job and rose to the occasion in a major way.
And then we had Baker, who was not a likely, as you write, apologist for Nixon, Senator Baker, who was also front and center.
Right, exactly. And who was the son-in-law of an Illinois senator who was sort of prominent at that point also. I won't mention his name either, but Baker was the and then he went on, of course, to become the Senate Majority Leader, a very very solid citizen.
And there have been other times. You remind us of the Estes Kefauver hearings, and some of those. Tell me about some of that was on television. But it wasn't national television.
Well, it was.
Oh, it was.
It blossomed very quickly into national television, just at a time when it was possible to have national television, when local television stations were beginning to form into networks, and so quiet time, you know, in the mid-afternoon, you had a choice of either the soap operas or a Senate investigation, turned out. And guess who won?
Oh, the Senate investigation won.
Well, of course.
Yeah, and then we had, of course, the other infamous senator from the state of Wisconsin, Senator Joseph McCarthy, and the hearings that, you know, eventually he was brought down. But that was quite a time in the Senate.
Well, exactly, and the availability of television certainly did not help his outcome, and I think he played to the cameras and. You think back to earlier times when, indeed, the Senate was not on television, and in some cases its deliberations were even behind closed doors. So the only people they could play to were one another when those doors were closed. And then they'd open the doors and they'd have journalists, and so they began to play to the galleries. And then in 1986, of course, C-SPAN was allowed to televise from that point on. And now we have social media, and it's really had an enormous impact, need I not say, to the way that the Senate operates.
There's a great picture of Senator John Glenn in the book who's got a makeup brush. He's pretending to put makeup on to talk about how the senators, there might be a little bit of vanity among them, would have to spruce themselves up for the camera.
They get great joy in teasing one another about that. On June 2nd, 1986, the first day on television, and Bob Dole was the majority leader at the time, and he got to give the first speech. And but the John Glenn photograph, which we were able to get from C-SPAN off the live feed, was just encapsulated the whole story very well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the other firsts here. Senator Margaret, I haven't thought about her in a long time. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, you have a picture of her at the Republican National Convention in 1964, the first woman elected to both houses of Congress and the first of her gender to have a major party convention place her name in nomination for President of the United States. Remind us of who she was.
Well, she was a very bright, outspoken, lady from the state of Maine who came up through the women's and professional associations. She went around giving lots of speeches throughout Maine, elected to the House of Representatives, and then in 1948, one of those banner years for sea changes, particularly after World War II, she won election to the Senate and was reelected until the election of 1974, when she was defeated by a Democrat named William Hathaway. And I remember her defeat very well because after she left in 1975, there were no women in the Senate. Until 1978. And you tell that to people today, and they just think that's impossible, incomprehensible. But she, of course, is most famous for her so-called declaration.
Oops. Oh, the phone went away again. Oh, I'm so sorry, everybody. Well, we'll get back to the story about we'll find him again. Something's wrong with the phones here, or in Washington, or wherever he is. We'll get back to the story of Senator Margaret Chase Smith, and I want to ask our guest what the thought is of her being nominated for president in 1964. That was pretty early on. What was the response to that? Our phone number, feel free. We're going to be back to phone calls momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to send questions that way, is talk@wpr.org, and we're also on Facebook, the Kathleen Dunn Show, there is still time. If you're just tuning us in, I'm sorry, we're not going to play that clip again, but we do have this little contest where what you get as your prize is the satisfaction of knowing that you know your history. I don't know if anybody's been able to write this down yet, but we played a clip of a former U.S. senator who had a best-selling record, and maybe you don't even need to hear that voice again to know who it was, so put it down on our Facebook page, and we'll be happy to tell you about the winners as we proceed. So we'll establish the connection and continue our conversation with Richard Baker. He is a historian. He was the first historian of the United States Senate, and he served until 2009, directed the United States Senate Historical Office from the time of its creation in 1975, and he is the co-author of The American Senate, An Insider's History. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we're back with our connection with Richard Baker, and we want to finish the story before we go back to phone calls of Senator Margaret Chase Smith. You were telling us about her, so please continue, Richard.
Well, I had conversations with her late in her life, and she looked back and said that the proudest moment of her life was in June of 1950 when she stood up on the floor of the Senate and attacked Joseph McCarthy.
Oh.
Her so-called declaration of conscience, not mentioning him by name, but it sort of got everyone's notice. She'd only been in the Senate a couple of years at that point, and none of the male senators really wanted to take her on. And she became an expert in military affairs. She was had a high position, the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So she really was a role model for many of the women who are in the Senate today.
Mm-hmm. And when she was nominated, her name was placed in nomination for president. What was the response to that? Were people aghast, or they think, oh yeah, the time is right?
Well, no, I think they realized it was kind of a token gesture. That's nice, and everybody loved her, but of course it's not going to happen, and there it was.
Mm-hmm.
Barry Goldwater got it instead.
Cynthia is our next caller. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. My question is about Senator Ted Kennedy. I'm sure he originally got in probably because of his name recognition, but I wanted to know what stellar things maybe he did during his career as a senator.
That's a very good question, and it's pretty timely because they've just opened the Edward M. Kennedy Center for the United States Senate up in Boston, right next to the John F. Kennedy Library. And you probably will find a good answer to your question up there. But I think I used to enjoy going into the gallery of the Senate chamber and just watch him debate. I didn't care what he was debating about, and it really wasn't debating. He was giving fiery speeches, and you could transport, you know, it didn't take much imagination to transport yourself back 100 years or more to the orators of the mid-19th century. That was his public face, but he was also a very good behind-the-scenes senator. Once he got his private life sort of straightened out and into the 1980s and 90s and after that, he really was smart. He knew the issues, and he knew how to bring other senators who had different views into a private room, sit down there, and kind of work it out. Some things they couldn't work out, but he knew the process better than many of the other senators of his day.
Hmm. What about his brother, Senator, then President, John F. Kennedy?
Well, there's still a debate. There's a new book out on him as focusing on his years in the Senate. And the general wisdom is that he wasn't much of a senator, that he had a lot of health problems, that he had interests outside the Senate that kind of attracted his energies and his time. But this new book tries to make the case that that indeed he accomplished a fair amount. He'd written the book Profiles in Courage, which won a Pulitzer Prize in the mid-1950s, and that's why he was involved in the selecting of the five outstanding senators. So he became somewhat of an expert on what it was to be an effective senator, although he really never had an opportunity, I think, to put that in those lessons into practice.
Hmm. LBJ.
I mean, Robert Caro, in his book Master of the Senate, has said it all. It took him 800 pages to say it. But I mean, LBJ had the rhythms. He understood the rhythms of this profoundly subtle institution. I mean, if a person is elected to the Senate and thinks that they can come and get up on the soapbox and give speeches and wheel and deal, they're profoundly mistaken. And LBJ's genius was that it only took him about 2 years before he really was able to do that and to put together deals. And the most important thing in a legislative body is to know, you know, when to hold them and when to fold them.
Mm-hmm.
When to move ahead and when to let a little more time go and let the pressure build up. And so he really was, for not very long, but for about 3 or perhaps 4 years in the late 1950s, a brilliant floor strategist. And then, of course, after he went off to be vice president and then president, Mike Mansfield came, and he was a profoundly different kind of leader because senators did not want another Lyndon Johnson bending their arms. They wanted somebody who would sort of be the consensus leadership, and that debate goes on today.
You have a picture, and I'm wondering if it typified a lot of his strong-arming tactics, where he is literally right in the face of, I can't remember who the senator was, trying to get him, persuade him to adopt a certain piece of legislation. Did he do that all the time, get right in somebody's face?
He did. In fact, if you visit the LBJ library today and go into the gift shop, they have that photograph. But without the other person, who in that case was Rhode Island Senator Theodore Green. But so that you can go and stand, and then they will take your picture.
Oh, that's funny.
So there it is at the LBJ Library, you know, the iconic figure image of LBJ.
That's funny. You've been asked this question, and I think the response is interesting, so I'm going to ask you as well. If people have been persuaded at any time during the Senate's history by absolutely illustrious oratory?
And we have a whole chapter on that in the book. The bottom line is that oratory, with the possible exception of the mid-19th century crises of the Union, oratory hasn't really done a lot to change many votes. Senior senators have been asked at the end of their careers, how many votes did debate? Did you change your mind on based on hearing the floor debate? And one senator famously said, "Well, let's see. Over the past 30 years, maybe about 4." But the votes are changed behind closed doors, and of course, a smart legislator will know that he or she has got a proposal to try to get a little support for that proposal before the sides harden. But want to retreat. Then the floor debate really becomes kind of as Woodrow Wilson said, senators at committee are senators at work. Senators are on the floor are senators at show. He didn't say it quite that way, but that was the idea.
Mm-hmm. And what about, from your perspective, were there speeches at some time in history by an individual senator that you found profound, riveting?
Well, certainly the Panama Canal Treaty debates, which indeed did get there. You know, NPR, Linda Wertheimer and her one other reporter covered that around the clock on radio, and that opened the door for television to come into the chamber. But the debates there were real, and all they needed were a few people to change their votes. And as it turned out, a number of senators lost the next election because they gave away, in the view of their opponents, gave away the Panama Canal. And so it was a really serious debate. And there are some people today who argue that the Panama Canal Treaty debates of 1977 and 78 were sort of the last real debates in the Senate where everything hung on being able to make a case on the floor of the Senate.
Oh, that's interesting. I understand that when you retired, it had been your desire that the Senate gallery be open when the Senate was in recess, and they did that for you. They opened it for the next week, is that right?
Well, the problem was that after 9/11, the Capitol Police on the Senate side said, we can't have the galleries opened when the Senate is not in session. You know, it's counterintuitive, it seems to me. They're open when the senators are down there on the floor. And so they closed them, and which meant that the chamber was closed during the whole vacation months of August, and people would come all the way to Washington. They could go over to the House of Representatives chamber and see that without any problem. But the Senate, for some reason, because of the Capitol Police, was closing its chamber. So I got up on my hobby horse on that one and lobbied a little bit. And in my farewell retirement party, both the majority leader, Harry Reid, and Mitch McConnell, the then Republican leader, said, we have a gift for you, and we're going to open the galleries full-time, not just for a couple of weeks, but forever, when the Senate's not in session. So I keep checking every once in a while. That hasn't changed.
That must have been a hard job to leave, Richard.
It was, but I did it for 33 years.
Oh.
My successor, who had been my assistant for 33 years, then took my place and did it for 5 years, and he just retired. So it's a very hard job to leave. But, you know, you sort of have to take a look at the clock and say maybe there are a couple of other things you want to do in life.
Like write a book about the history of the Senate.
And I had great fun writing this book on the history of the Senate with my collaborator, Neil McNeil.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. What about filibusters? Have they been around? What's the origin of filibusters?
Well, basically, filibusters began almost, you know, that's a very long debate. And some people will say, really, they didn't develop until the 1890s or later. But another school of thought says that there have been filibusters as long as there have been people in legislatures who have opposing points of view, like, let's say, 1789 at the very, very beginning. And one way to keep unwanted legislation from moving through the pipeline is to say, well, we can't really have a vote on that right now because we don't have everybody here in the chamber who would like to talk about it. And so throughout the 19th century, they'd have what they'd call disappearing quorum, both in the House and the Senate. And we go into that in great detail in the book. In the Senate, it was easier to kind of gridlock the Senate, get nothing done whatsoever. And so it was only the emergency of World War One that caused the Senate to come up with a rule to limit debate. But it wasn't much of a rule because it said, first of all, you had to get two-thirds of the members to vote to limit debate. And then after they imposed that limitation, each senator could still speak for an hour. So if you had 80 or 90 senators wishing to speak, you weren't getting any action. So that was really kind of tokenism. And it wasn't until the television era, really starting about 1975, when more serious limits on filibusters were put into place.
All right, we're going to now, we'll announce the winners, and then we can talk about this voice that we heard. We played earlier in the show the clip of the mellifluous former U.S. senator who also had a best-selling record. We'll hear about the record and the senator first. May we congratulate. You don't get anything other than knowing that you know your history, and a thank you for participating. We had some callers, actually. John in Milwaukee. Also, Robert from Manitowoc. Norm from Lake in the Hills, Illinois. And the senator is from Illinois. And also these people on Facebook, Ken Magier, M-A-G-I-E-R, Ed Anderson, David McKinley, Catherine Zissmeister, Arthur Bassler, and Evan Richards, Lank Daly, Linda Saylor, and Kathy Allen Wirtz. You all knew. Good for you. You know your history. And the senator was Richard. Tell us about him. An interesting guy.
Edward McKinley Dirksen.
Yeah.
He was one of a kind. literally, people. Ken Burns did a documentary history of Congress back in the late 1980s, and he still tells the story about the women who traveled all the way to Washington, knocked on the door of his majority leader's or his Republican leader's office, and he said, "Yes, ladies, what can I do for you?" And they say, "Oh, nothing, Senator. We just wanted to hear you speak." And of course, then he went on to become the grand marshal of the Tournament of Roses Parade in 1968. He's most remembered for his role in the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Without his support, without his arm twisting, there would not have been the votes to invoke cloture, to shut off the filibuster in order to move ahead with that bill. No civil rights legislation had ever been blocked by cloture until June of 1964, and that is largely the result of the persuasive abilities of Edward McKinley Dirksen.
Interesting. And he had a best-selling record, which is something.
Gallant men.
Yeah. So what do we do in the minute and a half or so that we have left to lessen partisanship in the Senate now?
Well, I think it starts with the leadership, and the leadership is under enormous pressures to keep looking behind them and make sure that their followers are still there. But back in Everett Dirksen's day, when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader of the Senate, they used to meet regularly to drink after hours, and they talked to each other multiple times. Even on up through more recent years, the Republican and Democratic leaders of the Senate have prided themselves in their ability to communicate regularly. But the current leaders, and it's a reflection of their times, I guess, take pride in not communicating, and that has to change. It seems to me. And Harry Reid has been a good leader, but he's gonna bow out after this Congress. And Mitch McConnell, who knows how much longer he'll be there. But the Senate, and one of the things we try to point out in this book, the Senate does, this is sort of like American history in general, it does operate in waves, and there are high points and there are low points. And I just hope we're sort of moving out of the low point back to some of the days when the Senate really was able to live up to the aspirations of the framers of the Constitution.
And when was that?
When was that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to read the book, and I know you have, but there are many examples in the book. Certainly, in the mid 19th century, in the reform, the progressive era, in the early 20th century, the Great Society of the where we had a lot of legislation that was sort of had been bottled up through the 1950s, on into I mentioned the Panama Canal Treaty debates, and this one school of thought that says, now we're approaching an era where there's a lot of bottled up legislation. The nation is in a major is in crisis on many fronts, and there's no alternative but to move ahead. And you won't get the whole pie, but you hopefully you'll get a couple of healthy slices.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us. Thanks for the book and for all the history.
Thank you. It was great fun. Thank you for the invitation.
Our pleasure. Richard Baker, our guest. The book is The American Senate, An Insider's History. And Richard knows the history because he was appointed the Senate's first official historian. He held the post from 1975 until his retirement in 2009. Thanks for entering our little quiz. I think we should do more of those. Who is this voice? Well, why don't we start doing that? It's kind of fun, isn't it? It was fun. Well, thank you to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, KP Whaley for doing our on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, we are going to be talking about the Detroit and what people are doing to resurrect the city. That will be at 2 o'clock during this hour. In the first hour of the program tomorrow, we will be talking about voting rights. So those are the lineups for our program tomorrow starting at 1 o'clock. Thanks very much for listening. News ahead and then Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.